talk about making the scriptures real, and this goes back to what we talked about at the beginning with your book. Like, the people in here are real. And for me, when I come to know these real people, and I say, okay, I'm a real person, they're a real person, they have things they struggle with, I have things I struggle with, when they become real to me, the things that they learn, I can apply them to myself better. And one of the fears I always have about this podcast or any podcast is that it becomes a replacement for studying the scriptures. And that's not what we want. But what I think you've done so masterfully for us here, and I want to thank you for it, is you've helped us make these people real. So now we want our audience to go in and really dig into these scriptures, knowing the real stories of these people. Hello, and welcome to the Scriptures Are Real podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about things that make the scriptures more real to us so we can draw more power out of them because we need all the help we can get. I'm your host, Carrie Muhlstein, and I'm so happy to have back with us a returning guest. We have Dr. Susan Black. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks, Carrie. It's a treat to be here, actually.
Our listeners, we won't do a huge introduction. Dr. Black is well known for all of her church history publications and so many wonderful things, taught in our college for a long time. She was with us when we did sections 10 and 11, so we'd refer you to that to learn a little bit more about her. But maybe I can just share a couple of things that our audience may be interested in. But before I do that, let me just let everyone know that this is the week that we're doing now, the Sunday of it. So usually I release these on a Sunday, and people watch them on that Sunday, and some people are watching it on that last Sunday. That last Sunday, that will be April 13th, that's Palm Sunday. And we are beginning our Holy Week that week. So we're having all sorts of little things we're doing here on the podcast. There'll be a different release each day. I'm trying to have different members of different faiths that will help us talk through Holy Week and what it's about and so on. But we're also doing a Palm Sunday walk. So for those of you who are in Utah and would like to come, my wife hosts this, Dr. Andrew Skinner. I'll be in Egypt at the time, sadly, but my wife hosts this, and Andrew Skinner will do some teaching there. It will start on the Murdoch Canal Trail. There's the Linden View Trailhead of the Murdoch Canal Trail at 4 p.m. If you want to join us, we just walk from there to the temple. We're doing palm fronds and things like that to celebrate Christ and the beginning of Holy Week. So we'd love to invite you to do that. Get on our Patreon website, tsr.website, for lots of resources about what you can do. The church is really helping us with this year. They're releasing also on their app things you can do to help celebrate each day of the Holy Week. So I think there are a lot of fantastic resources for you as you get into this. In any case, I wanted to talk about resources that Dr. Black has made available. Last time we showed the book Insights and Inspirations of the Doctrine and Covenants.
Doctrine and Covenants.
Yeah, that's right. I said Old Testament because I just submitted that
working
one.
Working on that one,
yeah.
Right?
and I also wanted to, I think it's particularly appropriate for today's talk. She wrote a book a number of years ago, I know, because I was using it when I was teaching early morning seminary back in like 1997. So it's called Who's Who in the Doctrine and Covenants. When I taught Doctrine and Covenants at BYU Hawaii, I taught it in seminary. It was invaluable for me. I still use it. If I didn't own it now, I would go out and buy it because it's invaluable for me, understanding the Doctrine and Covenants. It's a fantastic resource, so I'd recommend that to people. I think it's still available. But I know there's a fun story behind that book.
Right. Well, I, like you, was a teacher at the time. The year was, I think, 1986, maybe. I'm teaching at BYU and teaching a Doctrine and Covenants class. And I became interested in, what about the people in the Doctrine and Covenants? So I decided for a week I would stand outside between classes, and I would ask students who went by, could you tell me, do you know what Section 4 is about? And several said, oh, their mission president had very much wanted them to read and memorize Section 4, and some would even tell me they had memorized it.
Just so you know, George Durant was my MTC mission president, and he had me memorize that. So,
oh, good. Well, yeah. You get all these great people, right?
Yeah.
And so once they had said it, I said, well, do you know who it was given to? And several used the likening the scriptures unto themselves, and they said, well, it was for me. And I go, oh, for sure, but specifically, who was it given to? And I had answers all across the map. I even got Truman Madsen and Hugh Nibley were answers that came my way. And I go, oh, great, great. And then I said, well, do you know what their occupation was? And always in the 19th century, your best answer is they were a farmer. Yeah. And then there's something else, like a doctor, blacksmith. But I got responses like they were a teacher. One even said they were a computer scientist. And so as I realized all across the map, I'm wondering about the New Testament. And I'm wondering, where was there a historian that should have been walking behind Peter, James, and John? And what about Matthew and all the others? And suddenly I go, you know, what if I went through and found the people in the Doctrine and Covenants and I learned about their lives? And I'd say the book has been so successful that several have written books and put their names on it. And my, it sounds a lot like mine, but but nevertheless, it was just a wonderful experience. And I learned several things. First of all, the youngest person mentioned in the Doctrine and Covenants besides Joseph Smith was Heman Bassett at age 17. Oldest is Daniel Miles at age 69.
Wow.
So if you're younger or older, and listening audience, you're probably not going to be mentioned in modern scripture, right? But I also learned that the medium age being mentioned is about 39.
Huh.
And so I found it very interesting. I also went through and did all kinds of statistics of, did they stay faithful? Did they not? And then I did what we used to call years ago, the Paul Harvey experience. You know, what's the rest of the story? And so much of the Doctrine and Covenants is they're called to go on a journey.
Yes.
And then I began to look to figure out, did they go on that journey and did they stay faithful?
Mm.
And what may be of interest to our listening audience is that about 50% stayed faithful, but not always faithful. The most common group, it was like they were in and out, like they were going through revolving doors.
Mm.
And as we look at some of our people today, as we talk about them, we're going to say in and out. And then like the Kingston Trio, did they ever return? No, they'll never return. Their fate is still unknown. But it was an exciting project and helped me learn to love the people, those that stayed faithful all their days, like Brigham Young, John Taylor. And those that were in and out, like Partley P. Pratt.
Yeah, and Orson. Yeah,
and Orson, right, that we'll talk about today. And those that never returned, like Sidney Rigdon, that we'll mention today. So there's all kinds of people, but I'm very grateful because they were the first.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so appropriate for today. We're going to meet some really key figures today that are really key. They're key players. They influence the rest of church history. Well, at least, really, even up until today, I'd say Edward Partridge's influence is still felt today, and Sidney Rigdon's and so on. But the rest of this year, we will keep coming up against some of the names that we meet today, and they're important. So it's an exciting day with lots of great history behind it, and I'm glad you're here to guide us through it.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. So where would you like to go?
Okay, well, obviously, let's start with section 30, and we're going to go through section 36, depending on how long-winded I get, right? So we know as we start this that we're starting in September of 1830, and by the time we're in December of 1830, we've made it through section 36.
Yeah.
And each one of these revelations, as you look, they're basically taking place in Fayette, New York. And so you'd look at that time and you'd say you have three big pockets of believers. You have some that are meeting in Palmyra, Manchester area.
Yeah, and I think one of the revelations is there, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And then we have the central place is Fayette at the Whitmer home, the Peter Whitmer Sr. And then the largest branch of believers were out there in Colesville, New York.
Yeah, and that's the Knight family is the kind of core of that group.
Right, that's correct. And so as we start out, Notice we're just coming off the second conference of the church, which was held in September. So I wanted to say something about conferences.
Yeah.
We can't find that they're having like ward meetings. Ward meetings don't happen till Nauvoo.
Yeah, well, they don't really have wards. So,
right, yeah. So there's no wards at the time.
Yeah.
Just pockets of believers like branches.
Yeah.
And the other thing I think is interesting is that our conference is held in September. Yeah. And if you were to look, you can find the first conference held in June, second conference in September, then we get a conference in January, then we're back to June. And so you look today, and you'd say our conferences are held in April and October.
Yeah.
And that does not occur in the church until the Nauvoo era. And the reason for the April and October was in April, it's a military time. Every able-bodied man from 18 to 45 would gather in Nauvoo for the meetings of the Nauvoo Legion. And that was when you would begin, and they would have parading and mustering kind of thing. And then you'd say, when would they end the parading? It was always October. So when you look at Nauvoo and you'd say, who's in the Nauvoo Legion? There, the men 18 from 4 to 45 are coming in from one of the 23 towns in Nauvoo to come to Nauvoo to gather. And so it's a perfect time to hold conference, too.
Yeah.
And then the same thing. And they're also, several are coming from across the Mississippi River at that time, from 15 towns that Joseph had founded and still part of the Nauvoo Legion. So the conference time where we look at April and October doesn't happen till Nauvoo.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe our listening audience might enjoy that.
It was more frequent to begin with. And then as the church grew and as they had different organizations, then that changed. But it used to be like anyone in the church that could would, but mostly the church was in one place. So, we'll get to this later, but, you know, people from Missouri would come to Kirtland and all that kind of thing. But yeah, it's fascinating stuff. Yeah. So,
well, I think it is.
And maybe I can just kind of refer our audience to kind of tie us in with the last couple of episodes that we've done, which really have revolved around revelations that did revolve around that conference. So for example, Section 28, they're getting ready for the conference. Section 29 seems to happen just a couple days before the conference, but it's read in the conference along with some of the revelations that are part of the Book of Moses and so on. So really, the last several episodes, the last several sections, and a lot of the sections from today's are just before or just after this conference. As people are gathered, that's when they ask for answers to questions and Joseph gets revelations.
Good. Thank you. And this one is no exception.
Yeah.
So after the conference where they've partaken of the sacrament, they've transacted business, they've confirmed people, and as just before those who have assembled for basically a two-day conference are about to head out their separate ways, Joseph will receive revelations that used to be three revelations in the Book of Commandments and now combined to make Section 30.
Yeah.
So as we look, we're going to talk then about three different people. One is David Whitmer, and you'd say the Lord's chastising David. And I don't know if you'd want to be mentioned in the Book of Commandments or Doctrine and Covenants because you've been chastised. And then in the case of Peter Whitmer Jr., he's being called to accompany Oliver Cowdery out to Missouri to the borders of the Lamanites. And last, the John Whitmer. Yeah. And notice it's three brothers, all in their own ways. They are to proclaim the gospel. And in the case of David, to shape up before he does.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
So who do you want to talk about first?
Well, doesn't matter to me.
Okay. Well, maybe David, because he's mentioned first. Just a couple of things we know about David. Comes into the church because of his friend, Oliver Cowdery, who ultimately marries David's sister, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And so what we're looking at, we're really looking at the Whitmer family here.
Yeah.
as we do this one. You'd say, recall that David's the one that will convey Joseph and Oliver from Harmony, Pennsylvania at one point to the Whitmer home where the translation of the Book of Mormon will be completed. He'll also be one of the three witnesses of the Book of Mormon. And when the church is organized, he's considered one of the six original members. So you'd say of him, a very important man.
Yeah.
And then if we look after the revelation, what's he doing? You'd say his importance seems to increase, right? Yeah. And he becomes, he's appointed to be president of the Clay County High Council, and 4 days later to actually be president of the church in the state of Missouri. But you'd say, where does David falter? And wish that he had not, right?
Yeah.
But he's expressing sentiments against the prophet Joseph after the dedication of the Kirtland Temple. And he's saying that Joseph abandoned the primitive faith, that he's drifted into spiritual blindness. As a result, in Far West, in 1838, David will lose his fellowship and membership with the church. He'll stay estranged from the church all the days of his life.
Yeah.
And you get him flirting with the church. Once again, where you get William McClellan claiming, hey, he's going to reorganize the church. But that's short-lived. And finally, David will go on to a place called Richmond. He will be
in Missouri. Right?
Richmond in Missouri. He'll be the owner and proprietor of a livery and feed stable and no longer stands there today. But he goes on to organize his own church called the Church of Christ, which is short-lived. He will write a pamphlet called An Address to All Believers in Christ. He does this at age 82, and he will reject Brigham Young as the leader of the church. But the interesting thing, on his deathbed, he says to his attending physician, do you see me as a person of a sound mind? And the physician says yes. And then David then wants to bear his testimony that he knows the Book of Mormon is true. Yeah. So despite the fact that David left the church, just even a man that was one of the three witnesses to the Book of Mormon, he never lost his faith about the Book of Mormon.
Yeah. He was very true to that witness, as the angel instructed him that he should be.
Right.
Yeah.
Once you hit Doctrine and Covenants, section 30, verse 5 through 10, it's all about Peter Whitmer Jr. and John Whitmer.
Mm-hmm.
And for Peter Whitmer Jr., he has an opportunity to now join Oliver Cowdery on the mission to the Lamanites, right?
Yeah.
And notice, literally within the month, by October, Peter and Oliver are going to be out of there, right? And we'll get them soon joined by others. But you'd say, what happens to Peter Whitmer? And for Peter Whitmer, he does serve that mission to the Lamanites. It's interesting. He only has one statement that's recorded that he made while on that whole mission. And it was, we declared the Book of Mormon. And you're like, well, way to go, Peter.
Yeah.
And they did teach Native Americans along the way. They had a 1,500-mile journey. But what I like about Peter, he was a tailor by trade. And when they arrived in Independence, was he preaching? A little bit. But basically, you'd say he's in the sewing business.
Yeah.
And you get him sewing a suit for the very famous Alexander Doniphan. And you get him returning to the Independence area and actually moving in the room of the house of Lilburn W. Boggs.
Yeah. It works for him, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you'd say he sews a suit for his inauguration ceremonies. And you'd say for Peter, he's a nice guy. He serves on the Clay County High Council. But unfortunately for him, he dies in 1836 in Liberty, Clay County, And he's buried by the side of his brother Christian, who had died there. So you look and say, well, there's great tragedy for the Whitmers, especially as they come into Missouri.
I always wonder, and you know, this is just pure supposition, but I remember when Joseph was coming to work with the Whitmers because Oliver had told him, "Oh, you need to change the wording in that revelation." Peter's the one who helps Joseph convince the rest of the family to come around. And right. I always think, man, if Peter had lived when the family was starting to go apostate, would Peter have been able to help them come around?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Pull them back.
Yeah.
Yep. I don't know.
But I like Peter.
Yeah, me too. And then you look and you'd say, well, what about John? John's told to use the voice of a trump. And I always think that's what it means, to herald the news.
Yeah.
Not be quiet about it. John is one of the eight witnesses of the Book of Mormon. He actually helps with some of the translation, scribing when it comes to the Old Testament. And he becomes a historian of the church after Oliver Cowdery, and writes 96 pages of historical information. It's very valuable. But you'd say for him, despite all his efforts, you look and you'd say, what's happening to him? And he loses his membership. He refuses to give that history to Joseph Smith. He refuses to disclose any financial transactions that he's had with money from the church that's come to the poor and bleeding of Zion. And you'd say, what happens to him the rest of his life? Well, for him, when others are fleeing from the extermination order, he does not. He actually takes advantage of the saints when they're leaving far west. Obviously, they're forced out. Their property's for sale, and he gets some pretty good deals. He buys things at cheap prices.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it was in his name anyway, because he was the original purchaser of the land to then divvy out to other people. So a lot of it he was able to just hold on to because it was in his name in the first place.
So he's going to die at age 76, and he leaves his estate, which was actually prime farmland near Far West, livestock, two-story house, to family.
Yeah.
And you say, wow, John, what you could have been. He ended up financially well-to-do, but lost out on a lot of opportunities if he had stayed with the church.
Yeah, which is sad, very sad. One thing I appreciate about him is that he did kind of keep one of the properties he acquired was the temple lot, and he kept track of that, and he would let they would plow and do things to the other plots that he acquired around there, but he kept the temple lot separate and just kind of took care of it rather than chewing the land up to planned on and that kind of a thing. And so I always appreciated that he seemed to take the temple lot seriously, but I wish he would have just taken his church membership seriously.
That would have helped, right?
Yeah, but I'm grateful for the historical work he did. We're blessed by all of the historical work he did.
Well, moving on, if we go on to section 31, our topic is Thomas B. Marsh.
Yeah.
And Thomas B. Marsh, we know that as a young man, he's kind of a wanderlust person, and he ends up in New York City, becomes a grocery man. But he doesn't have much success in that. He moves on to Boston and works in a type foundry. He joins the Methodist Church, and he said he was about as successful in the Methodist Church as he had been in the grocery business. And so he's not having much luck, but he hears a rumor about a golden book out there in Western New York, and he decides to head out and check it out for himself. Well, the result will be he goes into E.B. Grandin's press, and he's pleased with the information he receives. He takes literally 16 pages back with him to Boston. He convinces his family to leave Boston to come to Western New York, be in Palmyra, and it will be there that he is baptized. He's ordained an elder. He's to proclaim the gospel, and as told in section 31, to lift up your voice and rejoice. But you'd say, how did he do? Well, you know, the rest of the story. He becomes the president of the Big Blue Branch there in Jackson County. He serves on the High Council. He becomes the president of the Quorum of the Twelve.
Yeah, the first president. So this is where our two sections tie together, because David Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery are two of the three people who are tasked to choose the Quorum of the 12. They choose Thomas B. Marsh, and then because of ages and so on, he becomes the first president.
Right, but yeah. I've often wondered if David W. Patton had really known his birthday, who could have been president, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it is that's mind-boggling for us to think someone didn't know their birth date, but we have to enter it in 12 times a day for anything we're doing. But he didn't know, and that is an interesting thing.
Yeah, it is interesting, but then you'd say, you know, everything he's doing is great. He even has the Quorum of the Twelve go on a mission to the East.
Yeah.
And then you'd say, well, what would call him to cause him to fall? And it's something so small.
Yeah.
And it has to do with strippings, making cheese.
Yeah.
And his wife. And the whole combination, you realize it's a calorie issue anyway. You know?
but I think it becomes a pride issue where his wife feels slighted and he's just going to stick with that no matter what. And you have to admire someone that's going to, you know, stand up for his wife. But at some point you hope, okay, can you see that maybe the two of you together could humble yourselves?
It's George Washington Harris and his wife that the issue is back and forth.
Yeah.
And you'd say for Harris, he's serving on the high council there. And so you can imagine you've got two leaders, both supporting their wives and eventually taken to the court of the first presidency.
Yeah. Yeah. Over who gets the most cream, right?
Right. Who gets the most cream. And the result for Thomas B. Marsh is, he's angry. And in his anger, he does something that affects not only himself, but the whole membership of the church in the state of Missouri, because he sends an affidavit to Lilburn W. Boggs, who's been wondering, what do I do about the problem of the Latter-day Saints in northern Missouri? And Boggs now reacts to the affidavit, and the conclusion is, he issues the extermination order.
Yeah.
You know, and with the extermination order, you'd say, the saints are struggling. They're forced out of the state of Missouri. But the question is, what happens to Thomas B. Marsh? Eventually, he and his wife separate. Thomas tries to support himself as a school teacher, and both of us could probably speak to the fallacy of that, right?
Yeah. Hard to support, yeah.
And his favorite topic to teach, and imagine you've got these one-room schoolhouses, but is biblical geography. And that's a tough class to fill even today, but to be taught it by someone who's never been in the Middle East, you know, I think you'd be a great teacher, but you'd say, well, what about Thomas B. Marsh? He struggles. And then he struggles also with his health. So notice he's lost his family, his health, his means. He's in poverty. And in 1857, Wandell Mace sees Thomas B. Marsh, who's 58 years old at the time, and he describes him as, quote, an old man, a stranger carrying a satchel and wearing a black waterproof coat to shield him from the storm. And he has a palsied frame. And you'd say, oh, boy, Thomas, you're in trouble. Well, finally, by the summer of 57, Thomas has made a choice. And his choice is he wants to join with the saints. He comes to see Brigham Young and wants to know whether he can be reconciled to him and if he can be reconciled to the Church of the Living God. And on September 6, 1857, Thomas spoke to a congregation of the saints on Temple Square and said, I want your fellowship. He said, I want your God to be my God. I have learned to understand what David said when he exclaimed, I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of God than to dwell in the tents of wickedness. At which point Brigham Young now brings it up to the congregation. and wants to know, could we extend the hand of fellowship to Thomas B. Marsh again? And to the credit of their saints, they raised their hands in affirmation, at which point Thomas remarked, I thank God for it. Yeah. And so with that, I thought I'd say something a little bit about Thomas what Brigham had to say. He said, in conversing with Brother Marsh, I find that he is about the same. He said, Thomas, that he always was. He is full of anecdotes and chit-chat. He has told me that he would be faithful and that he would do this and the other, but he does not know what he will do next week or next year. So the thought patterns of Thomas became pretty cloudy in the 1860s. Mm. John Taylor wrote of him, I remember hearing him talk in the 14th Ward Meeting House in Salt Lake City. It seemed to be about the most foolish and ridiculous talk, devoid of common sense, common intelligence, and common manhood that I had heard in a long time. And John Taylor said to himself, there is a specimen of apostasy. Mm. Well, John died a pauper, an invalid at age 67.
That's rough.
So I think, you know, he has so many years out, 18 years out of the church, and struggled. And although he had come back to the church, continued to struggle.
Yeah. And that is sad. I mean, one of the heartening things from it, it's a sad story, but one of the heartening things is I think we see this frequently, even today, when people who have been in the church, when they leave, it takes them a while sometimes, but often they realize, I miss what I had. Some people just move on, but a lot of people will start to recognize the absence of light that they once had and will come back. And so I'm grateful that he came back. I wish he would have just been able to stay in, but it's heartening. There are people that we all know today that we can have hope they will come back, because so often, and we see it all the time, people who are asking to have their records moved back into the church and that kind of a thing, because they've come to recognize that the light that they had when they were here was a good thing.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so moving on to section 32, it's about the missionaries to the Lamanites, and we learn that Oliver Cowdery and Peter Whitmer are not going to go alone.
Yeah.
That they've got two that are going to be added to them.
And maybe I'll just remind our audience, back in section 28, when, you know, Hiram Page was getting revelations about Zion, and God says, no one knows about Zion, no one knows where it is, but I'll tell you, and as part of it, I want Oliver Cowdery to go on a mission to the Lamanites. And so we have this mission that he was called to just at the earlier, somewhere in September of 1829, or I mean, sorry, 1830. And so this is October of 1830, so it's just a little after. They're still getting ready for that mission. It's really an eventful couple of months.
Right.
And this mission is going to change the church, we know, and so are some of the people talked about in this section. So sorry, keep going.
Right. So what we've got is you get two people that are now going to join this Oliver Cowdery and Peter Whitmer. So you've got Parley P. Pratt, who becomes the baptizer of the four. And then you've got a Ziba Peterson. And Ziba, you know, one of the people we can also trace back to the early Palmyra era. But of the two new that are joining, Parley P. Pratt, we know a lot about.
Yeah.
For him, he reads the Book of Mormon, and he describes sleeping is a burden, eating is a burden. All he wants to do is read the Book of Mormon. And I would describe him incredibly enthusiastic.
Yeah. And wasn't he in Canada? Tell me if I have this right, but he and his wife were on a boat traveling out to see family members, and he felt called to get off the boat and go and preach in the countryside. And it's while he's preaching in the countryside that he encounters the Book of Mormon.
Correct.
And has that experience. And then he goes to Manchester, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And so Parley, enthusiastic, but you'd say of the four, how would you like to have as a missionary companion Oliver Cowdery, who's received the priesthood from John the Baptist, Peter, James, and John, been the scribe to most of the Book of Mormon. But then you look at Ziba Peterson. He's interesting. He's faithful. And you'd say faithful at first, and even on the journey. But while on the journey, Joseph Smith receives a revelation that, you know, things aren't right with him. And you'd say, what's Ziba doing? The result will be is that he will be basically out of the church within a year of serving this mission. And for him, he stays in the Missouri area. He tries to support himself by being a school teacher. He eventually will take his family and move on to Northern California and will be a sheriff in a place called Dry Diggins that they'll change the name to Hangtown. When a sheriff, he hangs some renegades who had come into town, and he dies at age 39. And his wife moves from Hangtown to Napa Valley, where she purchases property from Lilburn W. Boggs. And so, that's you know, so they never quite get away from Boggs and the thing. But you look at the four missionaries, and you could say, oh, well, Wilford Woodruff described Oliver Cowdery's testimony that literally the earth would shake under his feet. And then you'd say, Peter Whitmer, he's probably your missionary, always concerned about, do we have enough money? And I'm going to stop and sew suits. And then you'd say, what's Parley doing? Oh, his baptismal clothes never seem dry, especially when they get in the Kirtland area. And then you'd say, Ziba Peterson, he's starting to wander even while on that mission.
Now, back to Parley, if it's right, I hope you can help me see if I'm remembering correctly. I think he goes to, once he hears about this, he goes to Manchester, and Joseph's not living there, but he finds Hiram.
Hiram.
And Hiram's the one who teaches him, and he gains his testimony while listening to Hiram, if I remember correctly.
Right.
Which is, I mean, good old steady Hiram, right? He's there taking care of the farm, and yet people come by. We're going to find in a minute others come by there as well, but Hiram, I mean, there's another big thing. Hiram converts Parley. Parley converts half the church in Ohio.
Right.
I mean, really, it does end up being almost half the church that joins in Ohio. And it's a domino effect that comes from good old steady Hiram.
Right. And if we look at section 33, it's also Hiram that brings in Ezra Thayer and Northrop Sweet. So you look and you'd say, probably Ezra is the most interesting of the two. He's a bridge he builds bridges, dams, and mills in the Palmyra area, but it's listening to Hiram preach that causes him. I thought I'd read what Ezra said. He said, when Hiram began to speak, every word touched me to the inmost soul. The tears rolled down my cheeks. When Hiram got through, he picked up a book and said, here is the Book of Mormon. I said, let me see it. I then opened the book and received a shock with such exquisite joy that no pen can write and no tongue can express. I shut the book and said, what is the price of it? 14 shillings was the reply. I said, I'll take the book. I opened it again and felt a double portion of the Spirit, and that I did not know whether I was in this world or not. I felt as though I were truly in heaven. So you'd say, who baptizes Ezra? Well, surprise, it's Parley P. Pratt. So you'd say, who lays the groundwork? You know, it's Hiram again.
Yeah.
And Parley comes in, and Joseph Smith confirms him. And you'd say, for him, he is faithful. He serves that mission with Northrop's Sweet that is literally a neighbor of his in Palmyra. But then you'd say, in the case of both men, you'd say they ultimately leave the church. Northrop, hard to say, right? Sweet. He leaves the church in 1831. And you know how there's all these break-off churches?
Yeah.
It's the first break-off church he leaves with that, with a man named Wycombe Clark, that founds what's called the Pure Church of Christ. And then you'd say, in the case of Ezra Thayer, when he leaves the church, it's like when there was the extermination order we've talked about. When there was the extermination order and the saints are fleeing from Missouri, he's been faithful, he flees all the way back to New York. and ultimately dies out in Michigan, and he's done with it. But he meets up with Northrop Sweet again in Michigan. And so you get the old missionary companions. They finally meet together, but in the case, both have left the church. And they showed up in Michigan. It's interesting, if you looked at like farming, the same crops that you could farm in Palmyra, they're in the same kind of zone that they work also farming in Michigan, and they both just end up there.
Wow, interesting.
So it's a story of two men that were companions that finally end up friends again.
And just as background, maybe to so we can get this, we'd had several of those revelations were in Fayette, but the one to Parley is in Manchester, right?
Right.
And then the one to Ezra and to Northrop is back again in Fayette. And we're in October for both of those.
Right. So you can see everything we've talked about so far, it's just within a 2-month period.
Yeah.
And shall we move on to the next?
Yeah.
We're getting them pretty fast.
Yeah.
But the next one is Section 34, Revelation to Orson Pratt. And what I like about it, Orson believed the promises in this revelation were almost too great for a person of as humble origin of myself ever to attain. So it might be like some of us get our patriarchal blessings and you're like, who, me?
Yeah.
You know, how is that possible?
Well, and Orson's just like 19, isn't he? So,
right.
I mean, you can see that it's just a young guy who's like, wow, this is big.
This is coming to me. He said, as the years came and went, and perhaps as we reread the blessings we have received, he said, I have often reflected upon this revelation and have oftentimes inquired in my heart, have I fulfilled the commandment as I ought to have done? Have I sought as earnestly as I ought to obtain the gift of prophecy so as to fulfill the requirement of heaven? And I like that. It's kind of like, although he goes on to greatness, he still wonders if he's done everything.
Yeah.
And as we get older, maybe we also have those wonderings. And which turn did I take I shouldn't have? And
yeah.
Which one should I have taken?
Which is amazing considering all that Orson does, right? He and Parley both jump out for a little while, but they come back in and, you know, he talks about his humble beginnings. But you read what both of those men write. These guys could think, right? They were great. Some of the great thinkers in the early days of the church. And he does so much, and he's still asking, did I do all that I should have done?
Right. Like at one point, you know, Orson's away from the body of the church for a long time because he serves, you know, so many missions.
Yeah.
And he continues to write. And some of the brethren at one point were talking about they didn't know if Orson really understood all the doctrine right. And when they were saying this in the presence of Brigham Young, I love Brigham's comment. He said, if Brother Orson were chopped up in 1-inch pieces, each piece would cry out Mormonism was true. And he says, leave him alone and leave him to me.
Well, that's great.
And
they did disagree sometimes, but still Brigham knew he believed.
Right.
Yeah.
And I liked Wilford Woodruff said of him, I think this is so good, and boy, I'd like it said of me, and perhaps you feel the same. He said, I never saw a man in my life that I know of that has spent as few moments idly as he has. I have never seen a storm at sea so heavy, even when shipping seas over the bow, side and stern, but what he would read his book. He has improved his time. I feel to thank God that I can still hear his voice.
That's beautiful.
I just think that's great.
It is.
So for all of us that are going, well, I wonder what's on TV tonight.
Yeah.
No, Orson would not be doing that.
And yet he's still asking, did I do everything I needed to do, right?
Yeah.
Now, I know you've just either finished or you're working on a book on the Salt Lake Temple. And so,
right?
Again, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Orson's the one who establishes a little observatory and observes the phases of the moon around the temple and then has those phases inscribed on the temple. Am I remembering
that's
correctly?
Him. And he chooses to do it in the month of April. Which I think, oh, isn't that great? Everything great happens in April,
yeah.
Including his observing then and with the moon.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a guy who, he says he's from humble origins, but he figures out he can do almost anything that he sets his mind to.
That's the way I see it. I see him as incredibly smart.
Yeah.
No doubt an honor student somewhere along the line.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Good guy.
Probably section 35 might be one you would like, but it's Sidney Rigdon, and he's being told, hey, Sidney, you've done a lot, but guess what? Greater things are ahead for you.
Yeah.
And it has everything to do with Oliver Cowdery Joseph Smith needs a scribe. He's had Oliver help scribe part of the Bible translation. Oliver, you know, he's serving a mission.
Yeah.
And then John Whitmer, hey, you're going to be a scribe, but guess what? You're going to be the historian and you're serving a mission. So who can the Lord turn to? And now it's Sidney Rigdon. And you may want to say about your feelings about the Bible translation.
Yeah, I'd love to and place that in here. So we've talked about this a little bit in previous sections, but we've had, and we'll talk about it again when we get to, section 29, we've talked about it. We'll do it more as we get to some things about Enoch in the future. But we had what ends up being Moses chapter 1 has come in June of this same year.
Right.
2 and 3 came in September, probably in conjunction with that conference. And then 4 and part of 5, either in conjunction with that conference or just after. And then we're getting in October, so at the same time as these other revelations that we're reading here, and I think that's worth stopping and thinking about. They're receiving, we have say, okay, well, this is a revelation that's Doctrine and Covenants. This is a revelation that's Joseph Smith translation. They're just getting it one revelation after the other and putting it all together. We'll separate it out into different places later, but they're getting it all together, and they're integrally tied together. And in fact, we'll just tell our audience, I did a lecture on this at a little workshop I did. We recorded it, and it's available on our Patreon website, tsar.website. If they want to go there, they can see the whole thing. But they are, during this October and November season, and then the December that's coming up, so the same time period the revelations we're doing today is when they're getting almost all, really, Moses 2 through most of the rest of the book of Moses. A little bit of it will come in January and February, but between September and October is when we get most of what is now the book of Moses. And as you said, Joseph Emma's scribe for a while, Oliver's scribe for a while, but none of them are going to be available. So Sidney Rigdon, who had been Parley's former minister, and Parley knew him, right? So Parley, on their way out, they've gone on this mission, and they're on their way out to the Lamanites, but Parley convinces them to stop in Kirtland because Sidney is there and these people he used to be with, and they preach. And Sidney, it's Sidney and Edward Partridge. So Edward Partridge, who is one of my heroes, I just absolutely love and look up to Edward Partridge. They have learned about it. They've come up here to learn more. They go to Manchester, in fact, and because Edward wants to see what is their home like? What is their farms like? That will tell me something about them. So he sees all of that up there with Sidney, and then they're going to come and meet Joseph. So we'll talk more about Edward in a minute. But Sidney is called to specifically to scribe for Joseph for that continued translation of the Bible, so that most of the rest of that translation will, especially where there's big chunks of new revelations, that comes with Sidney as scribe. And the impact of understanding more about Enoch and Adam and Noah is huge, and we'll continue to follow that for a few revelations as we go on. We see them interacting, but it's amazing and powerful for us.
Okay, and I think it's amazing how much is going on.
Yeah.
You know how you go trying to keep all the balls in the air?
Yeah.
But ours are pretty mundane. Do you go shopping? Do you fix the food? And suddenly you're like, you're talking revelations, you're talking, wow.
Yeah. In fact, I once counted out, I'll try and remember to put the reference to the article in our show notes, but where I went through and looked at the interaction of the Joseph Smith translation, or the translation of the Bible and the Doctrine and Covenants translations, and how the ideas build on each other. But I also counted out the amount of verses that Joseph is receiving. Mm-hmm. And if you add together the amount of verses that he receives that we put in the Doctrine and Covenants, plus the amount of verses he receives that we put in the Book of Moses. I would say November, December, and early January may be the most fruitful revelatory time in the history of the church, just in terms of sheer verse numbers. It's incredible how much revelation is coming.
Okay. You see what a pure shaft the prophet Joseph Smith is.
Yeah.
And that the Lord has brought him these different people.
Yeah.
Who are needed at the time to share the gospel. In other words, go out and do something because I've still got all these other things to do here.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. It is amazing just to think of the orchestration, right? And so we've kind of traced this a little bit, but let's just, if we could spend a moment on it. When you think of Parley Pratt on a boat and the Spirit tells him, get off.
Right.
And he finds a Book of Mormon that I think had been left by Samuel Smith, if I remember right, with a deacon, I can't remember his name, but anyway, and he reads that and is moved and goes to meet Hiram, and then he's converted. But then because of Parley, you get Sidney Rigdon and Edward Partridge, but literally hundreds of people joining in Kirtland. And then Edward Partridge and what he'll do as a bishop in Missouri and so on, that one person getting off the boat and finding the one Book of Mormon that Samuel Smith had left has an incredible impact on the church. And there's no doubt God orchestrated this, right? The saints were going to need to move to Ohio. They were going to have a huge group there. Parley is the one who can be the bridge between those groups. It's just miracle after miracle where you see God. I've heard our friends Hank Smith and John, by the way, talk about God playing 10D chess, right? I mean, the pieces he moves around to have the timing right, to make things happen the way they need to happen, is absolutely mind-blowing.
Okay, thank you. We sure see that. And we do see it now in our final section today, section 36. I think we're picking up along the way missionary work. The Lord wants his message out. And we get Edward Partridge going with his friend Sidney Rigdon all the way from the Kirtland, Ohio area, saying, hey, we do want to see Joseph.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty interesting. From they listen to the young prophet, and by the next day, Edward is ready to be baptized.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not I've got to think about it, let me go back home, talk to my wife. He's ready to join the church. And then you'd say, what's the message to he and Sidney? And the answer is, start preaching.
Yep.
Tell others. In other words, you know, the message just doesn't end with you. And the message you get from section 36 is always a message of repentance. In other words, tell the people what we have, and they're to return back. In other words, return back to the covenants of the ancients, which goes back to what he's translating there in Moses, and you can tie all these together. So maybe we try and make an effort here to tie all these together. But you get the Whitmers, mm-hmm. you get the Whitmer's brother-in-law Oliver Cowdery, and then you get people from the Palmyra area are coming in because they've heard Hiram preach, mm-hmm. right? So you get Ezra there, Northrop Sweet. You get Peter, Ziba Peterson, and then you get some coming from Kirtland because they've had the missionaries out there. So I think the message is, we share the gospel, we share it with the trump, we're loud.
Yeah.
And perhaps this broadcast is a way to share it with the trump, that we're not just talking about it in a living room or, you know, school or somewhere else. But it's an important message. I'm grateful that I've had a chance to be a missionary. What do you say about that?
Absolutely. And hopefully we're all being missionaries one way or the other, right? Preaching it with a trump. And one of the things I'm thinking of as we do this is, to me, like we talk about making the scriptures real. And this goes back to what we talked about at the beginning with your book, like the people in here are real.
Right.
And for me, when I come to know these real people, and I say, okay, I'm a real person, they're a real person, they have things they struggle with, I have things I struggle with. When they become real to me, the things that they learn I can apply them to myself better. And one of the fears I always have about this podcast or any podcast is that it becomes a replacement for studying the scriptures. And that's not what we want. But what I think you've done so masterfully for us here, and I want to thank you for it, is you've helped us make these people real. So now we want our audience to go in and really dig into these scriptures, knowing the real stories of these people, right? Knowing someone like Edward Partridge, who, as you said, he hears Joseph preach, and he says to Joseph, okay, I'm ready to be baptized. And Joseph says, well, why don't we wait till tomorrow? You're tired and everything. And he says, well, okay, I mean, I'm ready now, but if you want me to wait till tomorrow, I'll wait till tomorrow. That's fine. But, you know, we have real people like that. And then when we read the revelations to them, hopefully they become even more powerful in our lives. So to me, this is wonderful because I, at least in my mind, I hope it's driving everyone back into the scriptures. I hope our audience just really digs in there. That's when the Spirit will teach and edify. And you've really been masterful at setting the scene for that to happen. So thank you.
Hey, thank you. It's been a treat to be here. I'd like to close with my testimony. You know, I, like you, have studied the scriptures backwards and forwards, right? And I know that Joseph Smith was a great prophet. And I know that the Lord spoke to him and that these revelations to these wonderful individuals were from the Lord. And I also can testify that the Lord knows who we are and that he loves us. And in spite of all of our faults, right? And that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is the Lord's church upon the earth. And that the blessings come from being in the center, you know, not just on the fringes and kind of just touching them, but being a part. And I'm so grateful to live in this time when we have living prophets upon the earth today, even President Russell M. Nelson.
Amen to that.
Thanks.
Amen to that. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to our audience for joining us and to all those who help make this possible. We want to thank in particular today the Brockbanks and the Thanes, some families that have helped to donate. I don't know if you know that you can, since we're a 501c3, you can use donor advised funds, DAFs. I think they're a wonderful way to donate. Anyway, whatever way you donate, you can do that. But we're grateful for those who have made this possible. But I'm especially grateful for the Spirit I felt today. And anything we can do to share this in your family scripture study, get on your text chains with your family and your neighbors and say, do you know what I got out of this? And share with people so that we can all of us go to the scriptures and be blessed. That would be a wonderful thing. So thank you for joining us to our audience. And thank you, Dr. Black.
Thanks.